welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. Today, we're putting the spotlight on, as I can't resist calling them, books on crooks. We'll meet the dons, the godfathers, the swindlers, from Vegas to the Big Apple, down to Mexico. We'll preview fascinating fiction and nonfiction on guys that did the crime, and some, but not all, did the time. My guest today, Doug Swanson, is just out with Blood Aces, a page-turning bio of Benny Binion. Even if you've heard the name, you'll be intrigued and amazed by the true story of this Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. I think it's a sure bet you're going to find today's show thoroughly entertaining. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. Jay Sarno built two path-breaking Las Vegas casinos, Caesar's Palace in 1966 and Circus Circus in 1968. He planned but did not build a third, the Grandissimo, which many believe would have started the mega resort era a decade before Steve Wynn built the Mirage. Grandissimo, the First Emperor of Las Vegas by David Schwartz, tells the story of the man who created the template for modern-day Vegas, a place where ordinary people could leave their ordinary lives and have extraordinary adventures. Sarno sold out of Caesar's Palace shortly after it opened, partially to get away from the bookies and gangsters who'd taken over. He was forced to relinquish control of Circus Circus when the feds indicted him on charges of offering the largest bribe in IRS history, a bribe he freely admitted paying. Though he ultimately walked out of court a free man, he never got Circus back. And when he died in 1984, Grandissimo remained a dream. Eric Martin narrates.
Jay Sarno was used to bad luck, but this was ridiculous. He had gone home to Joyce and the kids to get one last night's sleep before the opening, but he had spent most of the night tossing and turning, sick over what was going on across town at his hotel. More than 2 years of planning, and so much was still up in the air. As he lay in bed on the morning of Friday, August 5th, 1966, he ran through some of his problems. First, there was the money. There wasn't enough of it. Although the Gaming Control Board had warned them about having a sufficient bankroll on hand before the place was ready to take bets, they had only $100,000 behind the cashier's window, not $350,000. This was a gamble. With a run of luck, winners could break the bank. The casino would have to close. Then there was the airline strike. Virtually all commercial airline traffic had been grounded for nearly a month now. With the rates he was charging, Sarno needed to draw a wealthier visitor than Las Vegas had seen before, the kind of jet-setters who wouldn't drive or take a train, let alone a bus. The downtown places were booming despite the strike, and the other strip casinos that relied heavily on weekenders driving up from Los Angeles were limping along. None of them were as vulnerable to the airline strike as he was. Even if they bussed people from Los Angeles and filled the hotel, it wouldn't help in the casino. Without the East Coast high rollers, without the mockers, this might be a big bust. Third, he and Nate Jacobson weren't getting along. They had an arrangement. Jay would be the idea man, and Nate would be the money man. But each wanted to be the boss. Jacobson infuriated Sarno with his penny-pinching. Sarno's disregard for the bottom line drove Jacobson nuts. Sensible adults who respected each other could see past these differences, but the tension between the two would-be bosses grew. Maybe it was because they were both self-described degenerate gamblers who figured that one of them winning meant the other was losing, but fundamentally, they just didn't like each other. Fourth, the place just wasn't ready to open. The night before, Stuart Mason had given him an honest assessment of how much work remained. The casino was mostly done, but guys were still laying carpet in the lobby. Half of the rooms wouldn't be ready for another 3 days. The first guests were due to arrive in 3 hours. Most of the rooms that overlooked the pool didn't have their plumbing hooked up. He lost track of how many rooms didn't have all their furniture. Several thousands of dollars worth of beds and chairs were still sitting in the parking lot. At least it hadn't rained. Then there were less immediate troubles. His friend Jimmy Hoffa had nearly exhausted his appeals and would probably be sitting in prison in a few months. Without his help at the Teamsters Union, Sarno might be cut off from the loans he would need to expand the hotel, and he would be without a powerful ally. Right now, declaring "Jimmy says so" ended more than one argument. A few months from now, who knew? Plus, there were rumors swirling in the papers that his casino was overrun by mobsters, that a crew of mafiosi had already divvied up control in the joint. Had they? He knew that Jerry Zarowitz didn't answer to him or Jacobson, but he couldn't say whether this would be a problem. There were plenty of reasons not to go ahead with the opening, to say that he had given the casino business his best shot and slink back to Atlanta, where the cabana guaranteed a living. But Sarno never thought of backing down. The uncertainty was wonderfully excruciating.
We've just heard Grandissimo by David Schwartz. Doug Swanson is an investigative reporter at the Dallas Morning News. He's also been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in feature writing. Doug has written 5 crime novels, including Big Town, which was a finalist for the prestigious Edgar Award. Today we'll speak with Doug about his new title, Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion. Welcome, Doug, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
How did you become aware of Benny's story?
I had been semi-aware for a long time because I've been a reporter in Texas for many years and covered police and crime news. So the name Benny Binion is still mentioned in crime circles here. And also I covered the World Series of Poker at one point. So I knew a little bit about Binion, but I didn't know the full story. In fact, I had no inkling of the full story until I got in and started doing some of the research. It was far more fascinating than I had initially understood.
I would have to agree with you there. You wrote, "You can't understand the town of Las Vegas without understanding Benny Binion. He put the gamble in Vegas." Why is he not as well known as, for example, Bugsy Siegel?
Well, that's a good question, and that's one I pondered myself. I think part of it is there had been no full biographical treatment of him, which I was delighted to find out, and so that was why I did the book. Second, I think there's the Hollywood angle. You know, Bugsy Siegel has been the subject of a number of films, and most famously, Bugsy, the film by Warren Beatty, which is a really good movie, but his history is completely off its rocker. I mean, it's just wrong. And Bugsy Siegel did not have that primary role that the film gives him. So there's a little bit of Hollywood misdirection here, and there's a little bit of just undeserved neglect of Binion's role. Out in Las Vegas, you can find a lot of people who knew Benny and will still talk about him. But outside of Vegas and outside of Dallas, he was just not well known.
You wrote that bootleggers could make in 1925 in Dallas $36,000. That's an amazing chunk of change. How many guys were pulling down that kind of money?
Well, Benny did it well. I don't know that everybody made that kind of money, but he claimed he never made all that much money doing it. But he was what he had done. He tapped into the best moonshine in the area. Now, there was a lot of bad moonshine running around. It had lead in it and other adulterants, and it would cause you to go blind or cripple you. And Benny brought in the purest stuff. So he soon had a reputation for having a good product. But he was always interested in getting in gambling. He wanted to get out of bootlegging and get into gambling. Bootlegging was just a stepping stone for him.
Well, Benny moved up to the dice games and attracted such players as Howard Hughes and H.L. Hunt. How did he get into those big leagues?
He was lucky. He was around in 1936 when the city of Dallas pretty much deregulated gambling. They didn't take it off the books. They didn't take the laws off the books, but they stopped enforcing the laws. So Benny came along at that time, and he saw his opening. He moved in, started his operations, and bought off the cops, bought off the judges, eliminated his rivals either by buying them off or by having them killed, and he soon controlled everything in Dallas and North Texas. So if you wanted to gamble at a high-stakes game, you were most likely gambling at a table controlled by Benny Binion.
You know, I love the story of what Benny did at the funeral of Clyde Barrow of Bonnie and Clyde fame. Can you share that?
Sure. Clyde Barrow, of course, died in the shootout in Louisiana, but he was brought back here to Dallas to be buried. In fact, I'm looking out the window now toward West Dallas. I can almost see the cemetery where he was buried. But when that happened, Benny Binion, supposedly, according to the story, got someone in an airplane to fly low over Barrow's funeral and drop a wreath onto the grave. It was typical of Benny Binion to cultivate people like that. I mean, he engendered loyalty, or he engendered fear, one or the other, sometimes both. But that's just the way he operated. He had a great eye for the common touch.
Okay, so speaking about fear, can you estimate how many men Benny murdered himself or ordered hits for?
No, I can't. I wish I could. That's one of the big questions. He admitted only to killing two people personally. He killed a rival bootlegger, and he killed a rival gambling operator. He never served any time because, as I said, he owned the authorities. What Binion did after that was he assembled a cast of hitmen who worked for him, and how many people they killed, that's anybody's guess. There are any number of bodies buried around or blown up or otherwise dispatched because they crossed Benny Binion. But if you can only, if you want to go strictly by the evidence, you can only pin two deaths on him.
We're speaking with Doug Swanson on The Book Report. What made Benny move to Las Vegas, or to put it another way, get out of Dodge?
Well, he had, as I said, he owned the sheriff, he owned the DA, he owned the police department, he owned the judges. But he then got caught in a bad situation because a reformed district attorney was elected, and a sheriff was elected who was aligned with one of his rivals. So Benny was told, you either need to get out of town or you're going to get killed or arrested. So he loaded up his Cadillac, supposedly with $1 million in cash. He got two of his henchmen with their Tommy guns and headed out for Las Vegas. And he rolled into Las Vegas in 1946 when the town was still not much of anything, just a few casinos scattered around downtown and a couple places out on the strip. And he was in the right place at the right time to be one of the founding fathers.
Right. Benny owned the Horseshoe, and then he turned that into the center of the craps universe. Then, of course, he created the World Series of Poker. Talk about that.
Yeah, he was he never wanted to have a place where you could come see a band or watch the chorus girls or anything like that. He always said he didn't want his money flowing out of the end of some guy's trumpet. He ran a gambling spot, and if you were a high-stakes gambler, that's where you went in Vegas. The World Series of Poker, he started in 1970 as just sort of a sideshow. He brought in a handful of the best poker players in the world. He cleared a space on his casino floor for the poker table, which he didn't have initially, and let them play and invited people to watch. And his desire, his hope was that some people would come in to watch this poker game and then would drift off to the casino tables and, you know, lose money at blackjack and dice and other games. He never thought that the World Series of Poker was going to be all that big. His biggest ambition for it was to have maybe 50 players. As we know today, it's thousands of players, and the purses are millions and millions of dollars.
Benny spent time in Leavenworth. What did they nail him for?
Like Al Capone, they got him for tax evasion. And one of the surprises in I found in my research was the effort to get Benny Binion went up through the FBI to J. Edgar Hoover and then all the way to the White House. President Harry Truman was kept apprised of what was going on with the investigation of Binion. They were trying to show that they were clamping down on tax cheats and big-time individuals. So they They went after Binion and they put him in Leavenworth for a few years.
Hmm. You know, I was absolutely blown away by a quote you found from Steve Wynn, who said, "The most unforgettable character I've ever met in my entire life. He's a perfectly honest man." Okay, so what planet is Steve Wynn living on?
No, it's true. Benny was very honest.
Okay. A murderer? A guy that ordered hits? But all right then. Okay.
I mean, there were some things he wouldn't talk about. For example, the people who ended up dead. But he was a straight shooter. I mean, he was very candid. That was one of the things people loved about him. He didn't blow any smoke. He was extremely approachable. He didn't even have an office. He had a table at the restaurant in the Horseshoe. Anybody could come up and talk to him, anybody in the world, and he would treat you like royalty, no matter who you were. And that's one of the things that endures still when people talk about him. He was what he always was, a very straight ahead, honest, fair dealing man from Texas, who also had a very pragmatic, brutal streak. If you got in his way, you regretted it, or you were dead.
I'll say.
For a friend, you just could not have a better friend. And Steve Wynn was a friend. I mean, see, he was one of Steve Wynn's mentors.
Huh.
So it worked out quite well for Steve Wynn.
Are you planning a book on Steve Wynn?
No, I think my wife won't go with me to Las Vegas anymore. She's had too many trips out there, so I'm going to have to do something else now.
Oh. But,
it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, I love the book, too. Tell us about Benny's kids. Did they go into the family business? Where are they now?
He had five children. One of them, Barbara, died either of a drug overdose or of a drug overdose. It was either accidental or intentional. That's still open to debate. Ted Binion, who's fairly famous, had a problem with heroin and strippers, and the combination of those things killed him. So three children survive. Jack Binion has been in the casino business for a long time. Has done really well. Becky Binion Bainin is still in Las Vegas, and she's been in and out of the casino business. And then Brenda Binion, who cooperated with me for the book, is a rancher in Amarillo, Texas. She never was in the casino business.
Hmm. So are you already at work on another book?
I'm working on a history of the Texas Rangers, not the baseball team, the law enforcement organization. There's a lot of, as with Binion, there are a lot of untold stories behind the legend. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, I can tell you, I'm going to be looking for it because you are one incredible writer. Doug, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Elaine. It was a great pleasure.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of Blood Aces, performed by John McClain.
Drinkers demanded a finished product, but suckers would pay for nothing but a chance. That's why Binion considered liquor a mere stepping stone. Soon he saw something that offered more promise than traffic in forbidden whiskey. He saw lucky numbers. "In about 1928, I opened up what they call a policy," he said. This propelled him into a wider and more adventurous criminal world, and the profits were sensational. The policy games were nothing more than simple lotteries in which players tried to pick three lucky digits. Each operator employed a team of runners, known as policy writers, who fanned out across town with sheets of numbers printed daily in red, green, and black. Players could bet a dime for a chance to win as much as $10. Winners were selected twice a day by the turning of the policy wheels. Some of the devices were actually spinning wheels, while others were small rotating barrels from which the winning numbers were plucked. Operators set the odds and controlled the payouts, and applied the fix as necessary. It was a common practice for them to survey the bets, determine which numbers would make the house the most money, and maneuver to select those. With no oversight, they ensured their own handsome returns. Policy operations stayed mobile to avoid raids and robberies. Not much equipment was needed. The wheel, a mimeograph to print tickets, and an adding machine to tally the proceeds. The game might spend time under bare light bulbs in a sweltering room of a fleabag hotel before decamping to the smoky rear parlors of a side street tavern. If operators got a tip that a raid was coming, they could pack up and be gone in minutes. Though Binion had entered the policy business with some apprehension, it didn't take long, about 12 hours, to see that he had strolled into a gold mine. "I started with $56, he recalled. "The first day I made $800. Even at its best, bootlegging never offered margins like that. A career was born. Policy games operated under a strict racial structure. The owners were white, and the customers were not. This represented a sizable base of potential gamblers. More than 30,000 blacks now lived in Dallas. Some of them were descendants of the slaves brought to Texas to work the cotton fields before the Civil War. Others had fled the exhausted timberlands and spent farms of East Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas. They generally filled the low end of the employment scale, as porters, maids, elevator operators, dishwashers, and other common laborers. They took, in other words, jobs that whites would not do. The white citizenry of Dallas tended to view the policy business with condescension and ridicule. "The policy game is mainly supported by Negroes, to whom a $10.50 return on a 10-cent investment is big money," the Dallas Morning News offered. The Daily Times Herald took it further in a front-page story that began this way: "Colored folks just gotta gamble. If they ain't got nothing else to bet on, they gonna bet on which way a bird fly when he leave off sitting. So there you is." This, with a sheepish grin, constituted the most lucid answer the shambling Negro could give to a question which was asked 10 of his race as they walked past City Hall. The same story allowed the head of the Dallas Police Vice Squad to offer his own theory. "Negroes just have to bet," Captain Max Doughty said. "Their gambling instincts seem to be much more thoroughly developed than those of whites." This ignored the fact that within a one-mile radius of the police station, there were at least a dozen illegal dice rooms, patronized by whites. The captain's attitude was hardly unusual. From its earliest days, Dallas had looked north in its moneyed aspirations and west in its frontier temperament. But in its race relations, it turned to the Old South. The town recorded its first lynchings in 1860, when three slaves were hanged after a raging fire destroyed most of the business district.
That was Blood Aces by Doug Swanson. In Spam Nation, investigative journalist and cybersecurity expert Brian Krebs shows us just how riveting a technology book can be. He unmasks the criminal masterminds driving some of the biggest spam and hacker operations targeting Americans and their bank accounts. Tracing the rise, fall, and alarming resurrection of the digital mafia behind the two largest spam pharmacies and countless viruses, phishing, and spyware attacks, Krebs delivers the first definitive narrative on the global spam problem and its threat to consumers everywhere. Christopher Lane performs the book that spotlights the drama and colorful personalities of a virtual war that impacts all of us.
On one side of the battle were the aforementioned Dmitry Stupin and Igor Gusev, and their sister pharmacy operations, GlovMed and Spamit. On the other was RX Promotion, a competing rogue internet pharmacy started by Gusev's former business partner, 35-year-old Muscovite Pavel Vrublevsky. Officially, Vrublevsky was the top executive at a company called ChronoPay, one of Russia's largest online payment processing firms, and a company that he and Gusev co-founded. In secret, he had deep ties to the cybercrime underworld, helping online miscreants of all stripes obtain credit card processing for their shady endeavors, and taking a hefty cut of the action. Rublevsky also is the co-founder and administrator of the popular spammer forum TrueTop.nu, and another pivotal figure in the cyber wars that have made us into a spam nation, or in reality, a world of spam, today. By 2010, I had spent more than a year investigating and reporting on allegations of corrupt business practices by Wroblewski and his reputed ties to spammers working for the RX Promotion Rogue Pharmacy Program, first as an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, and then for my own cybersecurity news website, KrebsOnSecurity.com. But as I dug deeper and deeper, I wanted to know more about the spam email and cybersecurity problem, who was driving it, and how to solve it. It was clear others did too. Prior to the war of attrition between spam kingpins that this book will explore, there was shockingly little public and reliable information available to answer the most basic questions facing the spam problem, such as, who is buying the stuff advertised in junk email, like Viagra, prescription drugs, and even Gucci purses? And what drives people to purchase and ingest pills pushed by these intrusive and unknown marketers? Are these drugs real or ineffective and possibly lethal fakes? Who is profiting from sending spam? How are the profits being divvied up, and where is the money going? Why is the pharmaceutical industry, one of the richest and most influential businesses in the world, seemingly powerless to stop the wholesale theft and hijacking of its products, trademarks, and customers? For that matter, why is it so easy to pay for these blatantly spam-advertised knockoffs with a credit card? Do customers have their credit card accounts hacked or resold after buying from spammers? What if they don't even buy from them? Are they still in danger? And what can consumers, policymakers, and law enforcement use to get control of the cybercrime epidemic? These are some of the questions people asked when I told them I was writing a book about spam. At the beginning, I could offer only my best guesses for answers. Even as I sought advice from purported spam experts, I discovered that some of the world's top authorities on spam didn't have a firm grip on the answers either. Many offered canned responses that seemed to be based on a handful of well-worn case studies, some of which were sponsored by major pharmaceutical or security companies, or both. Leaked pharmacy spam databases that I was able to obtain from RX Promotion and GlovMed Spamit during the pharma wars changed all of that, by providing a deep insider look at almost every significant aspect of the world's largest spam organizations. Perhaps ironically, the spammers themselves provided this glimpse into their shady doings that affect each of us every day. Hackers loyal to Gusev and Wroblewski leaked this information to certain law enforcement officials and to me in an attempt to sabotage each other. Instead, their databases offered unprecedented insight into the day-to-day operations and profits of these secretive international drug cartels, which comprise a loose affiliation of spammers, virus writers, shadowy suppliers, and shippers. The information in these databases also forms the basis of my reporting for many portions of this book.
We've just heard Spam Nation by Brian Krebs. Don Winslow's The Cartel is a rip-from-the-headline story of power, corruption, revenge, and justice spanning the past decade of the Mexican-American drug wars. It's 2004. DEA agent Art Keller has been fighting the war on drugs for 30 years in a blood feud against Adán Barrera, the head of El Federación, the world's most powerful cartel, and the man who brutally murdered Keller's partner. Finally putting Barrera away cost Keller dearly, the woman he loved, the beliefs he cherished, the life he wanted to lead. When Barrera gets out, determined to rebuild his empire, Keller goes on a 10-year odyssey to take him down. His obsession with justice becomes a ruthless struggle that stretches from Mexico to Washington, Berlin, and Barcelona. The Cartel is a true-to-life story of honor and sacrifice as one man tries to face down the devil without losing his soul. Ray Porter performs the book.
Don's operation employs scores of accountants to count the money and keep an eye on each other. Dozens of lawyers, hundreds of operatives, traffickers, security lookouts, police, army, politicians. Adan hired a convicted embezzler to digitize all his records so he can track accounts on computer, laptops that are swapped out once a month and freshly encoded. He uses scores of cell phones, changed every other day or so, the replacements smuggled in by guards or other of Diego's employees. Los Batiadores are in charge of managing Block 2. The rest of Puente Grande is a bedlam of gangs, robberies, assaults, and rapes, but Block 2 is quiet and orderly. Everyone knows that the Sinaloa cartel runs that part of the prison on behalf of Adan Barrera, and it is a sanctuary of calm and quiet. Adan rises early, has a quick breakfast, and then goes to his desk. He works until 1 o'clock p.m. when he has a leisurely lunch, then goes back to his desk until 5 o'clock. Most evenings are quiet. His chef comes in every day to cook his dinner and select the appropriate wine. It seems to matter a great deal to the chef. It matters less to Adan. He's not a wine snob. Some evenings, Los Batiadores convert the dining hall into a cinema, complete with a popcorn machine, and Adan invites friends in to watch a movie, munch popcorn or ice cream. The guests call these sessions family nights, because Adan prefers PG films, lots of Disney, because he doesn't like the sex and violence that come with most Hollywood films these days. Other nights are less wholesome. A prison guard cruises the Guadalajara bars and comes back with women, and then the dining hall is converted into a brothel, replete with liquor, drugs, and Viagra. Adan pays all the fees, but doesn't take part in these evenings, retreating to his cell instead. He's not interested in women, until he sees Magda. Sinaloans like to brag that their mountain state produces two beautiful things in abundance— poppies, and women. Magda Beltran is certainly one of the latter. 29 years old, with a tall frame, long legs, blue eyes. Magda is a mixture of the native Mexican people and the Swiss, German, and French who migrated to Sinaloa in the 19th century. 7 Sinaloanas have been crowned Miss Mexico. Magda wasn't one of them, but she was Miss Culiacán. She competed in beauty pageants since she was 6 years old and won most of them. In doing so, she attracted the attention of agents, film producers, and, of course, narcos. Magda was no stranger to that world. Her uncle was a trafficker in the old Federación, and 2 cousins had been sicarios for Miguel Ángel Barrera. Growing up in Culiacán, she simply knew traffickers. Most people did. She was 19 when she started dating them. Narcos flock around local beauty queens like circling vultures. Some of them even sponsor their own pageants, Narco Concursos de Misses, to bring out the talent. When some other pageant officials expressed concern about the girls associating with drug traffickers, one local wag asked, "Why would you not want these women representing the state's biggest product?" It's a natural combination. The girls have looks, and the narcos have money to treat them to gourmet dinners, clothes, jewelry, expensive vacations, spas, beauty treatments. Magda took them all. Why not? She was young and beautiful and wanted to have a good time. And if you wanted good times in Culiacán, if you wanted to hang with the cachorros, the jet-set kids of the drug barons, you had to go where the money was. Besides, the narcos were fun. They liked parties, music, dances, concerts, and clubs. If you were on the arm of a narco, you didn't stand in line behind the rope. They opened the rope for you and showed you into the VIP room with the cristal and the dom. And the owners, if the narco himself didn't own the club, would come over to greet you personally. Some of the girls found themselves enmeshed with the older narcos, who became obsessed with them. But Magda avoided that trap. She watched what happened to girls a few years ahead of her.
That was The Cartel by Dawn Winslow. When the BP oil spill devastates the Gulf Coast, those who made a living by shrimping find themselves in dire straits. For the oddballs and lowlifes who inhabit the sleepy working-class bayou town of Jeannette, these desperate circumstances serve as the catalyst that pushes them to enact whatever risky schemes they can dream up. At the center of Tom Cooper's The Marauders is Gus Lindquist, a one-armed treasure hunter obsessed with finding lost pirate treasure. His quest brings him into contact with a wide array of memorable characters, ranging from a couple of small-time criminal potheads to a smooth-talking oil company middleman to crazed drug-smuggling twins. As the story progresses, these characters find themselves on a collision course. P.J. Auckland narrates.
A month into his sentence, Cosgrove was dropped off in front of a derelict two-story Victorian with faded purple shutters and lopsided porch columns. It was late August and hot, sparrows keening in the gray-green oaks, bougainvilleas in moribund bloom. A bantam-bodied man with a small pinched face and a black ponytail hanging out the back of his camouflage baseball cap got out of the van with him. They stood on the sidewalk regarding the house.
"Good God Almighty," the ponytailed man said.
He had on a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers t-shirt and frayed denim shorts, two or three sizes too large, held up by a canvas belt with a gigantic gold and silver rodeo buckle engraved with the initials J.H.H. The deputy, a gourd-shaped Dominican named Lemon, looked at the ponytailed man and then glanced down at his clipboard.
"Hanson, is it?" he asked.
"John Henry Hanson," the ponytailed man said. "Yes, sir."
He hung his thumbs from his canvas belt.
"What does it look like, Hanson?"
Hanson turned again and considered the sagging house. Paint was peeling off the clapboards in great leprous swatches, and the front porch steps were spavined and weather-warped. Off to the side was a carport with a corrugated tin roof. No car, only buckets and paint cans and pallets of lumber, shovels and rakes and other gardening tools leaning against the walls.
"I'm no carpenter," Hanson said.
"Man of your mental caliber can manage a little sanding and painting, I'm sure," said Lemon. "You have any trouble with the hammer and nails, ask Cosgrove. He'll tell you which pound which."
Deputy Lemon got into the van and lurched away into the morning traffic. Hanson sidled up next to Cosgrove and watched the van turn down Magazine Street. Cosgrove, 6'2" with a lumberjack beard, felt like a grizzly bear next to the little guy.
"Bet that some bitch is on his way to fuck somebody's wife," Hanson said, gripping his belt buckle.
Up close, the house looked even worse than from the street, beyond hope of repair. The front windows were cockeyed, many of the panes broken and covered with scraps of cardboard. Here and there, the porch boards were missing, and from underneath the house, the ammonia stink of animal piss wafted up as strong as poison.
That was The Marauders by Tom Cooper. From the Bowery Boys and the Five Points Gang, through the rise of the Jewish Kosher Nostra and the Italian Mafia, mobsters have played a major role in New York's history. Anthony DeStefano's Gangland New York, The Places and Faces of Mob History, spotlights the big names: Monk Eastman, Lucky Luciano, Carlo Gambino, Meyer Lansky, Mickey Spillane, John Gotti, plus key players who may not have made headlines, but certainly made mob history. As families and factions fought for control, the city became a backdrop for crime scenes. The racket spread after World War II to docks, airports, food markets, and garment districts. The streets of Brooklyn, swamps of Staten Island, and vacant lots near LaGuardia hosted assassinations for the unlucky. The bloodlettings, arrests, and trials became front-page fodder for tabloids. Each of Gangland New York's five sections, one for each borough, traces criminal activities and area exploits from the 19th century to today. Everyone knows about Umberto's clam house in Little Italy, but Now you'll be introduced to Scarpato's restaurant in Coney Island, where Joe Masseria was killed by henchmen of Salvatore Maranzano, who in turn died on Park Avenue at the hands of Lucky Luciano. Gary Gallone narrates this on-the-ground guide to mob life in the Rotten Apple.
Once known as the Five Points for the way streets intersected, the spot was the first notorious center of crime in New York. It was popularized in Martin Scorsese's 2002 film Gangs of New York. Now the area is occupied largely by Columbus Park, where on most days you will find Chinese musicians playing lyrical Asian folk tunes as men play the Chinese version of checkers. Fortune tellers ply their trade, and children play on slides or take to the artificial turf of an athletic field off Mulberry Street. More than a century earlier, the neighborhood, known as Mulberry Bend, was home to dens of thieves and impoverished Italian immigrants who scraped by any way they could. It was a place that even in the late 19th century was considered so filthy and odious that the city every few days would send large trucks filled with a solution of carbolic acid, chloride of mercury, and potash to flush the gutters, streets, and houses where stale beer was sold for 2 cents a glass. It was around these vermin-infested hovels that photojournalist Jacob Riis took the iconic photographs of bandits hanging out at Donovan's Lane, another infamous thoroughfare of the criminal class. Immediately to the west of Columbus Park is the courthouse complex on Center Street with a new house of detention. But in the 19th century, what is now a park outside the criminal court used to be home to the Tombs, the notorious jail which was built on ground above the old Collect Pond, once a draw for the early settlers of Manhattan. The ground under the jail would inexorably sink into the saturated earth, forcing the city to abandon the site. The tens of thousands who pass by this location daily or lounge on its park benches are likely unaware that it was within the walls of the Tombs that the more notorious members of New York's original gangs, as well as other murderers, were executed by hanging from two sets of gallows. Walking just a few short blocks north, you will come across places known for celebrated gangland murders, such as the 1972 slaying outside Umberto's Clam House of Joey Crazy Joe Gallo, or the 1983 shooting of Chinese gang leader Michael Chen on Pell Street. Around the corner from Pell Street is the angled Doyer Street, where the Chinatown Tong Wars littered the pavement with blood and bodies during their battles of the early 20th century. Then there is the site of the old Ravenite Social Club on Mulberry Street, where the late John J. Gotti held court and got arrested for the last time one frigid December night in 1990. Gotti's fate was sealed by secret FBI recordings made by a bug planted in an apartment 3 floors up from the club. Those are just a few of the sites within easy walking distance of the Five Points. Walk a bit farther, and you will come across many other infamous places. While the history and headlines of organized crime may be largely focused in Manhattan, anyone who has looked into the various mobs operating in the Big Apple knows that all the other boroughs have also earned spots on a list of important places in crime lore. Inside the long-defunct Nuova Villa Tamaro restaurant in Coney Island one afternoon in 1931, the feared and hated mob boss Joseph Masseria was shot dead in a coup by his rivals while waiting for his lunch. This was one of the seismic episodes in the 1930s which set the stage for modern organized crime. On a quiet residential street in Brooklyn, the loan shark James Jimmy Doyle Plumeri was dumped after being strangled in 1971. Powerful mafia captain Anthony, little Augie Paisano, Carfano, and former beauty contestant Janice Drake were shot dead in a car on a quiet Queen Street in 1959. 40 years later, on a quiet Bronx street, Bonanno crime family captain Gerlando George from Canada, Schiascia, was found with numerous bullet holes in his face and body after being killed on orders from family boss Joseph Massino, a murder which forever soured the alliance between the Canadian mob and the Bonanno family. Another one of Massino's victims, Sonny Black Napolitano, was killed in the basement of a house on Staten Island and buried in a body bag in a wooded area near South Street. Like Napolitano, lots of mob-hit victims were unceremoniously disposed of without the benefits of receiving last rites or a proper burial. Staten Island was a favorite dumping ground of killer Thomas Tommy Karate Patera, since it had a lot of wooded areas and nature preserves.
That was Gangland, New York by Anthony DiStefano. Philip Carr's The Lady from Zagreb was one of my favorite books last year. As today's topic is books on crooks, I'm taking us back to Bernie Gunther's world in A Man Without Breath. Berlin, 1943. A month has passed since the stunning defeat at Stalingrad. Though Hitler insists Germany is winning the war, commanders on the ground know better. Then, word reaches Berlin of a red massacre of Polish officers in the Katyn Forest near Smolensk. If true, the message it would send to the troops is clear: fight on or risk certain death. For once, both the Wehrmacht and propaganda minister Goebbels want the same thing: irrefutable evidence of this Russian atrocity. The Wehrmacht believes such proof will soften the reality of its own war crimes. For Goebbels, such proof could turn the tide of the war by destroying the alliance, cutting Russia off from its western supply lines. Both parties agree the ensuing investigation must be overseen by a professional trained in sifting evidence and interrogating witnesses. Policeman Bernie Gunther is dispatched to Smolensk, where truth becomes a victim of war. Paul Hecht narrates.
Before I could offer my opinion, the air raid warning siren sounded. We all looked at each other in surprise. It had been almost 2 years since the last air raid by the Royal Air Force. "We should go to the shelter," I said. "Or the basement, perhaps?" Maya nodded. "Yes, you're right," he said firmly. "You should all go, just in case it's for real." I fetched my coat and hat off the stand and turned back to Maya. "But you're coming too, aren't you?" I said. "Jews aren't permitted in the shelters. Perhaps you didn't notice it before. Well, there's no reason why you should have. I don't think there's been an air raid since we started to wear the yellow star." I shook my head. "No, I didn't," I shrugged. "So where are Jews supposed to go?" "To hell, of course. At least that's what they hope." This time, Meyer's grin was sardonic. "Besides, people know this is a Jewish apartment, and since the law requires that homes be left with their doors and windows open to minimize the effect of a pressure wave from a bomb blast, that's also an invitation to some local thief to come and steal from us." He shook his head. "So, I shall stay here." I glanced out of the window. In the street below, hundreds of people were already being herded toward the local shelter by uniformed police. There wasn't much time to lose. "Franz," said Sief, "we're not going there without you. Just leave your coat. If they can't see your star, they'll have to assume you're German. You can carry me in and say I fainted, and if I show my pass and say I'm your wife, then no one will be any the wiser." "She's right," I said. "And if I'm arrested, what then? I've only just been released." Meyer shook his head and laughed. "Besides, it's probably a false alarm. Hasn't Fat Hermann promised us that this is the best defended city in Europe?" The siren continued to wail outside like some dreadful mechanical clarion announcing the end of a night shift in the smoking factories of hell. Sief Meyer sat down at the table and clasped her hands tight. "If you're not going, then I'm not going." "Neither am I," Clara said, sitting down beside her. "There's no time to argue about this," said Maya. "You should go, all of you." "He's right," I said, more urgently now, as already we could hear the drone of the bombers in the distance. It was obvious this was no false alarm. I opened the door and waved the four women toward me. "Come on," I said. "No," said Sief, "we're staying." The two other sisters glanced at each other and then sat down alongside their Jewish brother-in-law. This left me on my feet, with a coat in my hand and a nervous look on my face. After all, I'd seen what our own bombers had done to Minsk and parts of France. I put on the coat and shoved my hands in the pockets so as to conceal the fact that they were shaking. I don't think they're coming to drop propaganda leaflets, I said. Not this time. Yes, but it's not civilians like us they're after, surely, said Steve. It's the government district. They'll know there's a hospital near here. The RAF won't want to risk hitting the Catholic hospital, will they? The English aren't like that. It's the Wilhelmstrasse they'll be after. How will they know from 2,000 feet up in the air? I heard myself utter weakly. She's right, said Meyer. It's not the west of Berlin they're targeting, it's the east, which means it's probably just as well we're none of us in Rosenstrasse tonight. He smiled at me.
That was A Man Without Breath by Philip Carr. Mario Puzo wrote, Italians have a little joke. The world is so hard, a man must have two fathers to look after him. That's why they have godfathers. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this lineup of stories of flawed, fascinating men. For more titles across the spectrum, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.